Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. This is where top performers share their secrets to help you achieve your personal and your professional goals. I am your host, Denise Griffiths, and together with my amazing guests, we bring you inspiring and actionable insights aimed to take your life and your business to the next level. Ranked in the top 2% globally, this podcast really is a must listen, and it's because of my guest. So whether you're tuning in for entrepreneurial tips, career advice, or personal development strategies, get ready to turn inspiration into action, challenges into triumphs, and dreams into reality. And my guest today, Alex Fink, is the founder and CEO of The Other Web. It's a new platform that allows its readers to read news and commentary, listen to podcasts, and search the web without paywalls, clickbait ads, auto-playing videos, affiliate links, or any other junk. And it is junk. So Alex came up with the idea for Other Web after realizing that the world doesn't need more cameras and information, and I'll get him to explain what that means, but rather a solution to filter out the abundance of low-quality, trivial, and quite often false information that plagues the internet. So after spending 15 years building perception systems like cameras and computer vision technology, he had an epiphany that he really wasn't making the world better by creating more ways to generate data and information. And he recognized that people are constantly bombarded with superficial clickbait, misinformation, and as I mentioned, junk content. Now that content generates ad revenue for creators, but this is important. It fills people's minds with an illusion of knowledge. Good morning, Alex, and welcome to Your Partner in Success. I'm excited to have you here.
Good morning, Denise.
Tell us a bit about you and how you show up in the world.
Well, I show up in the world in the Soviet Union in 1984. So I have these memories from my childhood of essentially being surrounded by adults who are supposed to know a lot because they are adults, but they're consuming propaganda all the time. So they really have no idea what's going on. And so any question that I ask about what's going on, I usually get the official version, then a wink, and then, but we're 99% sure it's false, but we're not really sure. And it's this odd environment where I see that the people who are supposed to know don't know. Right. And my parents used to wake up at 4 a.m. every morning and lock themselves in the closet or in the bathroom, someplace where the neighbors won't hear, and then listen to the radio to hear Voice of America. That was the one source of information that we had that was somewhat correlated to reality. Now, of course, we know today it was American propaganda aimed at the Soviet Union, but it was much better than anything available in the Soviet Union itself. So I think this is probably what's feeding my lifelong fascination with news and with knowing what's going on in the world, because that one source of information, Voice of America, is probably the reason why we left a few months before there was war in our hometown. Right. So our timing was substantially better than any of our neighbors'. So having good information leads to better actions. And consuming junk all day probably does the opposite.
We were talking about that in the green room, you know, how I'm an ardent advocate of reading and learning history, always have been. And what I'm seeing now these days is people just don't know history. They just don't.
Well, they're absolutely not. And certainly the information ecosystem we've created is not helping them learn history. In fact, it seems like we're erasing a lot of things in history that might be inconvenient, but they're still useful to know.
We have to know our history. We really do. And I've got old books in my bookcases. When I left home, you know, got out of school, got married, left home, I took every encyclopedia in my mom's house. She didn't even notice it, but I took them all. It's like, okay, Mom, gotta go back. And off I hauled all these. I've got 30 of them, I think. Do you know, I still go back and I read those, even as elderly as they are. You can't find a lot of that information now. And that scares me.
That's true. So I grew up in an unusual house, you could say. We had about 3,000 books when we were back in the Soviet Union. And you have to consider that a book cost 5 rubles, and my father's salary, he was an engineer, was 200 rubles, right? So those 3,000 books were basically like 5 years of salary. But that's what my parents considered the most important possession they had. And it was really painful when we were moving to Israel when I was six. We could only carry so much with us. So we had to select the 600 best because that's what fit in one crate that we could ship. And yeah, so books are kind of sacred in my family. And history books obviously are very important. The problem with history is that, well, sometimes you don't know what really happened. And the victors wrote the version that you're reading.
The
And
victor always tells the best story, always.
Well, no, sometimes there's exciting stories being told after the fact as kind of an alternative history. And those are always very entertaining to read because you don't know for sure which one's true. If both of them make sense and have some evidence, then maybe the truth is somewhere in the middle. So I tend to geek out on these things quite a bit. You just have to always have humility and assume that you can't tell for sure. Don't form any strong opinions. You weren't there.
And particularly now with Liz, I don't watch TV. I closed cable TV off. Oh God, 2010. I knew then. I mean, I never did watch much TV, but I learned to really hate it. So every once in a while, I'll turn it on, but I go to a DVD or something. I just don't watch whatever is being served up by what I consider to be talking heads. I just won't do it.
Yeah, so that's another element that we're sort of fast forwarding to the current world, right? If an algorithm or a bunch of marketing executives in the room decided that this is what you should consume next, you probably shouldn't, right? That decision wasn't made with your best interest in mind. It was made with the goal of getting as much of your attention as possible to use it for somebody else's needs, right? So you're not getting value in this deal with a cable TV channel or with YouTube or with any other free platform, essentially. The deal is they get as much out of you, and that's what they use to choose the programming. And it's not malicious intent in some sense, it's the benign profit motive.
And we are, you know, we thrive on capitalism. So I understand that part. But I also wish that more people would use some critical thinking skills and say, that doesn't sound quite right to me. Let me go find out a bit more. And listen, I understand that even my old, you know, and their red bound books, my encyclopedias, I suspect a lot of that is garbage as well. But, you know, I've got it and I'm going to dig around and see what I can do and then do some comparison. I like to contrast and compare, compare and contrast. I don't take anything at heart value or whatever somebody's saying to me. I'm like, and I'm filtering it through my perceptions. We all do that. But with clickbait and everything else that's going on, I think that some of our, and this is just my personal thought, I think a lot of our critical thinking skills are getting blunted.
I think that's certainly the case. And again, I am going to defend regular people in this process quite extensively. So, first of all, we've done a poll using the Harris Polling Company a while ago. And a few of the questions we were asking were like, do you think the following sentence is true or false? And one of the sentences we asked was, I spend more time today consuming political news than I did 5 years ago. More than 80% of the respondents said yes. So they're spending more time. And then another question we asked was, I have a harder time telling what is true or false in today's political climate. And again, the vast majority of people said yes. So people are spending more time, but they have a harder time figuring out what is true. That means the problem isn't quite critical thinking. It's the signal to noise ratio has just gone down.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay. All of you critical thinkers, I'm sorry, because I am one and I beat myself up all the time.
All right. Now, let me synthesize those 2 points, though, because I don't think they contradict each other. I think that if you're spending most of your time in this mode of trying to filter out things that are obviously nonsensical, like let's say you open CNN and the first article you see is titled, Stop What You're Doing and Watch This Elephant Play with Bubbles. That's an actual CNN article. I'm not making this up,
Oh, you're
right?
kidding me.
Yeah.
Really? I don't pay any attention to CNN.
I know. I'm just using them as an example for this reason. If that's what you see all day, and you're just in this mode of bubbles, not bubbles, bubbles, not bubbles, that's what you're doing when you're reading the news, then you cannot also be in the mode of critically evaluating whether or not this source that is being cited in this article is anonymous or it's credible. Can I trust it? Can I not trust it? Right? If you're thinking about superficial stuff all the time, what Daniel Kahneman would call system one, then you cannot also be thinking about complex calculations, what Daniel Kahneman would call system two. You're in one of those two modes. You cannot be in both at once. And so I think because we're bombarded with this junk all the time, we're constantly in this mode of just filtering the elephants, blowing bubbles, right? And when we do that, then we miss the elephant in the room, which is sometimes there are claims that just don't make sense, but they seem much deeper and more profound than the elephant blowing bubbles, so we accept them at face value.
You know, I'm going to be seeing bubbles all day, right? You know this. It's going to be in my head. I'm a picture
Apologize.
thinker. That's okay. I think in pictures, and I've already got this, and it's not a pink elephant. It's kind of a grayish elephant, but it's got a big smile on his face blowing bubbles. I'm not going to lose that for a while. So thanks for that.
I think that was the entire point when CNN published that
Exactly.
article. But yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and since we're talking about CNE, CNN, and I'm going to use my air quotes here, when it comes to journalism, air quotes, AI seems to be a double-edged sword. So let's talk about that. How is AI affecting the journalism landscape from what you're seeing?
It's even more than two edges, I would say. So we've been essentially trying to use AI as just a faster editor, right? So we basically trained our AI models to do what good editors in the past used to do, like check that there's multiple sources for every claim, check that the headline matches the content, check that the language is not too sensationalist and that it just describes the fact at hand without trying to persuade or inject anything, right? So that's what we've been using it for because it's just faster. An editor can maybe go through 200 articles in a day, whereas our AI can go through an infinite number of them. It's obviously not going to be as good, but it's accelerated, right? A lot of people have been using AI to basically generate low quality content, even lower than what has been created before. So if you think about the average BuzzFeed of the world, I'm going to use them as an example because they're out of business now, right? So
Oh,
the
aren't they?
average
I
Buzz,
didn't know that. I didn't pay
well,
attention to them either.
they closed their newsroom. So BuzzFeed
Wow.
itself as an organization exists, but BuzzFeed News, they basically laid off all the 180 or so people that they had working for that
Oh, wow.
outfit. That was around 2 years ago, I would say. Yeah, they got rid of their New York office, which was very fancy prime real estate. So yeah, that model did not work. So I'm gonna pick on them for a second because it's a victimless crime then. They used to basically publish clickbait all day, right? And there were a lot of writers there that actually kind of admitted in public that they're paid by the word, they're paid for volume, and so they have to generate a lot of content. And let's say that writer was really prolific. He was generating 15, 20 articles per day that are pure clickbait. With the help of generative AI, that same person can generate 500 articles and they
Ouch.
will look roughly the same, right? In
Right.
fact, they might be better for clickbait purposes. So that's another way in which AI is kind of polluting the ecosystem. It just making people who create low quality content much more efficient at doing so. And now there's a third way that I think is about to come to the fore. If not, then we'll push it there, which is that we can really use AI to generate content with much more transparency than a journalist whose motives and biases you don't know. Right. So if the AI model has been trained on something that we can open to the world, right? So the data set and the code of the model are, if not open source, then at least source available. Then maybe you can actually trust that model more than you would trust a human journalist or a human editor. Obviously, we still need humans to find out the facts. We can't send an AI model to talk to a whistleblower in a parking garage somewhere, Right, but
No,
like,
soon,
well,
huh?
not yet.
Isn't Elon Musk making robots? Maybe we can deploy
Yeah, so Optimus or Boston Dynamics, I guess one of
them.
those will save us. But I'm not sure whistleblowers will be so keen on disclosing all their biggest secrets to a robot. We'll see. But suppose that will take a bit longer, but we are getting into the world into a world where I think the AI models are becoming as good as humans at just writing, right? They don't know what to write about, they don't know what is true and what is false. But if you just give them a set of facts and say, write 600 words describing those facts in the most eloquent manner, and then you give the exact same tasks to humans, I think the models are going to start beating humans sometime this year.
I think you're right. Listen, I play around a lot on ChatGPT and I love Perplexity. And what I do is I will give them what I wrote and ask them to clean it up, and they do a terrific job, but I don't ask them to write it for me. I ask them to just tidy it up and make it more eloquent, to use your word, and easier to read. That works for me. Now, I'm not going to get them to say, "Oh, hey, write this article for me." I write the article.
So I should mention I've been playing around with quite a few of those models myself because we have our own version that is better. But so I have to keep tabs on the competition. ChatGPT is still kind of writing as an undergrad student writes an essay when they want to get an A, right? They're trying to impress you. And I guess it makes sense given how it was trained, right? And given who was giving it most of the human feedback during the reinforcement learning phase, right? That was students in Kenya, I think. And so it makes sense that it writes like a student trying to impress. It's actually really hard to get it to stop using unnecessarily big words or too many commas in a sentence or things like that, right? It's trying to sound smart. But again, you can fine-tune any of those models with a bit of programming skill and come up with your own model that writes
And
the way
it's
you want it to write.
right. Isn't
And
that what you have done?
yep. Well, so we've done quite a few things in parallel, right? But one of them that we haven't quite announced yet, but it's coming up soon, is going to be an article synthesizer that journalists can use to basically write the first draft. And it's already confusing some people. We've sent some outputs of our model along with a New York Times article about the exact same subject to professional editors and asked them to rank which one's better without telling them which is which. And it's already kind of 50-50, even though half of those were written by AI. And no, none of them could guess until we told them that they're actually ranking AI articles. So it's getting to the point where, surprise, surprise, a model that was trained on human text is able to generate text that looks like something a human would write. And if you train it only on text that was written by the best humans, right, the professional journalists and writers, it's going to start sounding like them. So it's getting really good. We should still be very careful and not use it out of scope. Don't ask ChatGPT to tell you whether something is true or not. How on earth would ChatGPT know that? Right? All it did was read the internet, and most of the internet is junk.
Exactly. And I wanted to, since we're talking about journalism in a roundabout kind of way, is journalism really worse in quality, kind of like what you were just talking about with your comparisons? Or has bad journalism just always existed to some degree?
I think it's always existed, but the question is what was incentivized over the past 20 years? And I think that sometime around 2003, we became really, really good at tracking advertising online. We could track every click, we could track every view, and that was not possible until then. And so the moment that happens, since most content is monetized using advertising and most ads started paying per click or per view, now you had this constant pressure on all content to basically evolve towards whatever maximizes clicks and views. And that happens to be clickbait. So I think journalism has gotten worse. Even the best outlets had to essentially relax their standards. And if you just search, let's say, the New York Times, I'll keep picking on them, search how many articles they published in the past year with a single anonymous source corroborating their claim. And then search the previous 4 decades. And I think this year they had more than in the previous 4 decades. It's just the standards are becoming looser. There is no way what gets published right now would pass editorial review 20 years ago. But they have to publish now because if not, somebody else will beat them. Whoever publishes that same story first, even if it is without any proper sourcing and it happens to be false, will still get more eyeballs than whoever comes in 3 minutes later. And so the standards are much looser. I think the only types of outlets that maintain their standards and haven't changed a thing are either news agencies like Reuters, AP, things like that. They have other problems, but they don't have editorial standard problems at least. And the other one is financial press, especially outlets like the Financial Times that are really expensive and therefore insulated from the pressures of advertisers. They maintain their standards, but most people can't read them because it's $400 a year to get access. So.
Right. And see, when I see any article, I don't care who wrote it, where it appeared. If I see anonymous, I just assume it's a bald-faced lie and I keep on moving.
Right. Well, so for an article by itself, I would say I actually take the purest approach and I want to read even if I don't know who wrote it. Right. There's been actually a few good authors online in past years who wrote under a pseudonym.
And really?
That was still useful to read.
Right? Okay.
Well, historically, that happened quite a bit. I think the American founding fathers published their stuff under pseudonyms, right?
Yeah, they did, yeah.
But still, it was still worth reading, I assume. So at that level, that's not a problem, right? Because a person could be writing, but stating facts that are corroborated by something else, right? And in that case, I don't care who the author is. I'm reading the facts. But if the writer, even if it's a named writer, makes a claim, and their proof that the claim is true is an anonymous source, I have strong doubts, right? Mm. I understand why sometimes you have to do this, like Watergate, you probably need an anonymous source, right? Pentagon Papers, you probably need an anonymous source. Everything else though, you probably need two named sources. And that's the old editorial standard we used to have for every newspaper in the country until 5 minutes ago.
It's a shame. It really is. When I was a kid, I was thinking about this before we jumped on the call this morning. When I was a kid, my parents were very politically, not motivated, but interested. And, you know, we spent time around, you know, the local mayor and, you know, the different elite people. I guess I didn't know they were elite. I knew that I didn't trust them, even as a child. Because I would listen to what they were saying and I would watch what they were doing. And I was told as a kid, oh, these are the smartest people in the room. Actually, they're not. In some cases, they were downright dumb, but they had charisma. They could speak well. People liked them. People trusted them. And I'm looking at them going, oh, I have all of my life been deeply suspicious of political people. You know, yeah. Particularly career politicians.
And I think I'm going to defer to the eloquence of Douglas Adams here, who said anyone capable of getting themselves elected into office should on no account be allowed to do the job.
Exactly. And I, you know, I felt that way as a kid. Apparently I was very smart as a child, but, and the older I get and the more I read and watch these people, the more I think, who let you out of the bathroom today? Who tied your shoes for you? I mean, I have very little respect for particularly career politicians, but
well,
it is what it is.
Yeah, it's a pretty questionable profession choice. There are some professions where if somebody chooses that, I'm trying to wonder what is wrong with them. Is it megalomania? Is it narcissism? Right. But
all of the above.
Why would anyone else choose this profession?
I know. Right? I think they're missing something in their moral makeup.
I mean, and again, there are exceptions to this. You mentioned career politicians, but some people go into politics after a successful career in something else just because they figure, okay, I've seen what is broken in the world and I'll go into the place that is broken and try to fix it. And I respect those people. I think most of the time they get burnt and they leave. We saw Andrew Yang a couple of years ago. That was a good example, right? He tried, but he had no idea what's coming his way. I think he is still surprised and kind of in shock after what he's seen there.
Well, you know, I will not vote for incumbents. I just won't. And I have this sign on my door that says, if you weren't invited or I don't expect you, don't knock or ring. And come political silly season, here come the politicians. And I call their little door hangers spam. You know, they just, I won't open the door to them. And I have a glass door. So if they can see me looking at them and saying, look at the sign, read the sign, can you read? And the one time I did open the door was to a doctor that I knew. I had worked with him in different, I just lost my train of thought, with different free clinic type of things. It's a one of those political things where you go in and you just do some volunteering of your time. I can't even talk today. Nice man, really liked him as a doctor, but he got into politics and he made it twice. And then he decided that he was not going to win the third time. So he was going to switch to another, spot in the government. And he came, "Oh, Denise, it's good to see you. I'd like your vote." And I said, "No, I'm sorry." And I told him why. I said, "Listen, you did your time. I think you did some good work, but it's time to go back, as the founding fathers meant, to your real work. I cannot vote for another incumbent." And he did lose that time. But I mean, he was shocked when I wasn't ugly about it. I was just, "No, I'm sorry, I can't. You're an incumbent. You've been there twice. You've been there long enough. I cannot vote for you." I wish more people would do that. Just say, "Nope, you've done your time. Moving on."
Well, I think it would be nice, but this is in the realm of just dreaming. It would
I
be nice
know.
if we had
I
not just
know.
term limits for some specific jobs, which we also need, right? But if we had the limit on how many times you're allowed to job hop inside government, because the system we have right now results in odd situations like second terms of governors are almost always devoid of any governing, right? They're spent campaigning for a possible run at the presidency. That's what a second term is for in most states in the US, especially the big ones. And so you're looking at that and thinking, okay, can at least the state fix it so that they have a functioning governor most of the time? Like, put a cool off period into the state constitution. It's not that hard. But I don't know. No state in the US has that, as far as I know. And that's a little odd to
No,
me. Now,
they
speaking of
don't.
signs, just so that you know, I also have a sign on our front door that says, "Don't ring the bell, don't make it weird." It works most of the time, but occasionally somebody rings and I open the door and they start talking and I like pause them with my finger, point to the sign and close the
I have done that. I mean, I'll be
door.
standing there looking them dead in the eye, going and pointing at the sign. It's been there as long. I bought this house in 2005. That sign has been there since 2005. UPS won't ring my doorbell. They're scared. They know better.
I've had that happen too. Somebody brought a delivery from Uber Eats and got like paused in front of the door and didn't know what to do next.
I actually have to put in my little notes, please do knock and ring or something. Let me know you're here. But yeah, it's crazy. I wanted to ask you, and we've talked about clickbait and we've talked about outright fake news and misinformation. How is your company working with this? How are you helping people to get past this?
So the way we started was, first we thought, if we're trying to help people consume higher quality information, let's try to define what higher quality is. And we came to the conclusion that the easiest way to define higher quality is to list all the things that we definitely know are bad, learn how to detect those, and then basically define quality as 100 minus all the penalties for stuff that you did that is wrong. Right, so you mentioned clickbait. Clickbait is pretty easy to define. It's an attention-grabbing headline that doesn't match the body of the article. So we trained the model to detect that just as well as a human editor would. And then we defined about 20 of these negative traits. And now we have models that detect all of them. We calculate an overall score that people can sort articles by, but we also give people additional information. So if you go into our newsfeed, you will see that every article has a bullet point summary. So you don't have to rely on the headline. You can look at the summary of what's in the article, and maybe that doesn't interest you, and you just don't want to read the article after you read the summary. And we also have a nutrition label next to each one, where basically all the outputs of the models are shown to you so that you know everything we know about this article, or at least most of it. And that basically helps people select for themselves. It's not that they're relying on us for the selection, they just have more tools to select. We also implemented a whole bunch of customizations that people can do. So for every topic, there is a slider where you can set exactly how much you want from this topic, like how many articles, for every emotion that an article is likely to evoke in you. you can also set a slider that says how much do you like getting this emotion from articles. So if you don't like depressing articles, you just push the depressing slider to zero, and you won't get anything that our models classified as possibly depressing. Likewise, if you want educational content, you can maximize that, right? So it's really up to you. We want the user to be in control of their feed. And that was everything I told you is what we've done until about a month ago. And then a month ago, we asked ourselves the question, do you really need a newsfeed? Or maybe we can create a concierge, for lack of a better word, that will do all of this for you. And you will just tell them what you want to hear right now. And it will look through the news, summarize the news for you based on what you asked, and give you the answer. So we're experimenting with that. It's not perfect yet. But we think that once we get this method right, then this concierge will know your preferences. You will be able to tell it how you want to tweak your preferences. And that's just a better way to consume news than to look through a list of items, right?
Yeah.
Why would you go through 100 articles and pick three if you can just have somebody or something summarize those three for you in a single answer?
Exactly. Now, you founded OtherWeb in 2021, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And I think you told me in our pre-interview that you have something like 4 million users right now.
It's north of 9, so I guess our pre-interview was
really?
a while ago. But yeah, so we actually didn't launch the platform in 2021. 2021, we just started developing models. So the website launched in August 22, and then the mobile apps launched in November 22. So it's been about a year and a half in operation. And yes, we just crossed 9 million in total.
Congratulations. So what do you think, in your view, because you've built this, it's your baby, what do you want people to know about it? What do you think can really be of help to them?
Let me start from what I hope people would do, right? And then we'll talk about what I want them to know. What I hope people would do is that they will start caring more about what they put into their brain, because we know we should watch what we eat, because it affects our health. But somehow we've kind of not been paying attention to what we feed our mind, and has been affecting our mental health, our decision-making, etc. So what I hope people would do is start planning what they consume mentally, right? And start deciding what information they want to get and from where. And once they do that, I'm trying to create the best tool to make this process as efficient as possible. But honestly, it's not the only tool. Right. If you don't use the other web, great, use something else. Right. I just want people to know what's going on in the world instead of consuming elephants blowing bubbles all day. And if the
you
other
did that
web
on purpose.
Is
I know you did. Darn it.
I'm just trying to point out the elephant in the room.
Yeah, I want the elephants floating above my head right now, but thanks for that.
But like the other web is a tool. I'm trying to make the best tool for the job. And, you know, I have a great team that is obviously working on this day and night. But ultimately, I want people to solve the problem. I don't necessarily want them to use this specific tool for it. I'm just trying to make the best tool to solve that particular problem.
Okay, so keep on going. This is fascinating to me.
Well, I don't know in which direction to keep on going, but...
just talk. I'm looking at the bubbles right now, so
I need to pull you out of the bubble.
Yeah.
Okay, so I should also mention that we registered OtherWeb as a public benefit corporation, which basically means we like money, we like the profit motive, but there should be something else, some other purpose for which an organization exists. And if you look at how C Corps are incorporated, well, there is nothing else, right? If they have a mission, it's nowhere in the incorporation papers because it's not binding in any way. It's just written for PR purposes. We wanted to write our mission right there so that it is binding on me and on all other executives. And I already mentioned that the mission is to improve the quality of information people consume. So it's a non-standard structure that is meant to essentially bind their future selves so that if either I become corrupt in the future or if somebody replaces me who doesn't quite have the strong opinions I have on quality of information and why it's important, I want the paperwork to still bind them and force us as a company to continue not to do evil, because, well, some companies start with don't do evil and then end up doing things that are questionable after that.
This is true. We're talking about politicians. I don't think, at least I don't like to think that most of them start out going, ooh, I can make millions of dollars. Many of them do. I like to think that most of them started out as humans, you know, good, well-intentioned humans, and then something happens along the way, but we'll never know. We never really, we just don't know.
And I think I agree with you there, in that I'll keep with my motive that I started from the beginning, which is I always assume people have good intentions. I always give people the benefit of the doubt. And I know that most people are really good at rationalizing things. And so very few people do bad things with the intention of doing bad things. Most of the time, they do things that we perceive as bad because they've convinced themselves that these things are really good. And so somebody goes into politics with the intention of being in politics, right? I don't think they planned beyond that for the most part. But then once they are in politics, they face certain pressures and they think that they're forced to kind of do this thing that 5 years ago they would think it's bad, right? But now they feel compelled to do that because that's the only way to get reelected. And once they do that, now they come up with a story of why that's actually good for everybody. Right, everybody wants me to be reelected because you know that's good for society. So even if I break this law a little bit in the corner just to get myself reelected, well, that's still good for everybody. So I really did something good. Those kind of stories, I think, are what most people tell themselves when they do bad stuff.
Oh, I think you're right. So, what I know you started this, but you started out. Tell us your origin story. What were you doing before you did this?
Well, so I guess it depends on how far we go. So I mentioned Soviet Union. I moved to Israel when I was six. So basically, I grew up in Israel all the way through my bachelor's degree. I lived there. Then I moved to Japan for a year and worked on building video cameras for the Japanese camera makers. After that, I moved to California. I was in Silicon Valley for about 10 years. And I essentially worked my way up first until I was vice president of engineering at a VR camera company. And then I quit and I started my own technical consulting company that was basically helping companies that did something else build cameras into stuff. So my customers were everything from self-driving trucks to baby monitors to companies that made paramilitary equipment and rifle scopes and things like that that were digital and therefore were essentially a video camera inside, right? So anything that captures video and does something with it, whether it's processing it through an algorithm like in computer vision or making it nice and showing it to humans, that was my bread and butter. We shipped more than 35 different products during those 7 years that I ran that company. And then when other webs started picking up steam, that's when I wound it down and decided no more cameras for me unless it's a really close friend asking for help or something.
Now, why did you, how did Otherweb come into your head? I mean, how did that land in your psyche and you knew you had to create it?
Well, I've been walking around with a similar idea for several years before that because, again, I had this observation. I didn't quite know what to do with it, but it seemed to me like content quality is becoming worse. People are becoming less informed. And when I tried to diagnose what the root cause is, what is causing this ailment, it seemed like pay-per-click and pay-per-view advertising were somehow at the root of it, right? If you pay per click or per view, then it doesn't just affect the ad itself, it affects the content that the ad appears on. The content is going to become more clickbaity over time. And so I've been walking around with this idea. And at some point, when I had my moments of doubt about what I'm doing with my life, usually it's after I get into an argument with a customer who I consider to be particularly stupid, right, in the camera business. Then I had a conversation with my wife. I complained about how stupid my customers are, or at least that particular one. And she said, "Well, it seems like you're unhappy with what you're doing. What do you really want to do?" I said, "Well, you know, if I had unlimited resources, I would probably work on this big problem that I'm observing all around me, but I probably can't because, you know, that requires a lot of investment. I'm not sure I can afford it. It's, you know, I need to support the family, et cetera." And then she said, "Well, can't you afford not to work for 3 years? Will we have enough?" I said, "Yeah, I think we will." She said, "Well, go work on it then." So it was basically
Wow.
my wife that pushed me to take the leap and
Good
stop
for
making money
her.
for a while to try to build something meaningful. I mean, hopefully that something meaningful will translate into money as well. But for now, that's kind of not my personal goal, at least. My personal goal is try to achieve the mission, and hopefully that creates value for people. And typically, when you create value for people, then you get money in return for that value.
You absolutely do. So, what is some of the feedback? I mean, you said you've got 9 million users. I'm sure you're getting some great feedback. Can you share some of that?
Well, there's quite a bit. So just recently, I was talking to somebody who's a master's student in journalism, actually. And she was blown away and was saying she's been looking for something like this for many, many years. She wants to know how she can help, et cetera. So I'm getting a lot of this kind of very positive feedback. I'm getting some skeptical feedback, especially from the industry itself, like
Oh, I would think.
especially editors. When they realize that we're automating the work of an editor to some extent, they become upset and start lecturing me about how we don't know anything and how professional editors know so much and our AI models are obviously not as good. And I say, yes, I agree, but they're just faster than you. They're not as good. But so there's a little bit of that. But we've also gotten a lot of journalists who even came on as advisors who were excited by this idea. And when it comes to the political divide in our country, I'm kind of happy to say that the number of angry emails I get from people complaining about the left-wing stuff on the platform is roughly equal to the number of angry emails I get complaining about the right-wing stuff on the platform. So we're balanced in that the number of haters we have from the right and from the left is roughly equal. And that's because we include content from both sides, right? We don't filter out politically. We don't try to tilt the scale. We try to maintain the center as much as we can and open up the Overton window to basically everything from Breitbart all the way to Mother Jones, right? Probably don't go more extreme than that. I'm not sure that people will appreciate that. But we try not to stick to a very narrow sort of strip of what people are consuming. We think people need variety in their diet as well, especially if we already made it easier for them to read more by creating these short summaries. All right. So that's been kind of the approach. The feedback is fairly balanced. At the same time, I'm realizing that the way that AI is going to change this industry will also change the model of the app, right? Because you can't just continue to aggregate articles from journalists if AI is basically reducing the cost of writing content to zero and therefore putting most journalists out of work.
You know, the thing with AI, and we hear this everywhere from all corners, oh, AI is going to take my job. Doesn't matter if you're a script writer in Hollywood. It doesn't matter if you're a musician. It doesn't matter if you're me, a web developer or podcast host. Nobody's taking my job. I'm my job. I don't know why people are so panicked over it.
Well, if you are your job, then you're safe. But let me use an analogy to kind of explain why I think they have some truth to what they're saying. In 1920, 30% of the US population worked in agriculture. By 1930, 3% of the US population worked in agriculture. Why? Because tractors, right? We automated some elements of the work. And so it's not like farmers ceased to exist, is that one farmer could do the work of 10 farmers. And there's only so much food you need in the US, right? Otherwise, it would just all spoil. And food is not easily exported, right? And I think the same applies to many other things like journalism. And so ultimately, a lot of people, 27% of the US population just from that decade alone, needed to find something else to do. And I think we are about to see a very similar transition for every profession where the output is words. And so that includes journalists and screenwriters, et cetera. It's not like those professions will cease to exist, but we will be able to do much more than we're doing now with far fewer people. And so a
Yeah.
very large number of people will need to find something else to do. And that's scary and that's painful. And people are actually really not good with change, right? I could
No, they're
also argue
not.
that that change from the 1920s, the US still hasn't quite recovered from it.
No kidding. We still have daylight savings time. We are not an agrarian society.
Well, that's one
Nobody
element
reads
of it, but
that.
also we still have inner city ghettos that are mostly populated by the descendants of people from the Great Migration of the 20s, right? And
Oh.
so we haven't quite recovered from that. The people who left the South back then, even their descendants right now, are poorer than the rest of the population. We haven't been able to fix that gap. And I say we, I wasn't here at the time, obviously. I only moved to the US 16 years ago. But the point is that change is hard and you need to plan for it. And yes, a big change is coming.
And I really like what you said about, 50-50 content. I'm going to read both sides because I do want to understand. Now, my eyebrows are going to hit my hairline and I'm going to look permanently surprised at some of it. But I do want to know what people are thinking, but I want it from a decent source, no clickbait. I'm not going to go, oh, I'm left or I'm right, and there's nothing in between. There's plenty in between.
And take it from an immigrant. I'm constantly surprised. That doesn't matter which side of the political aisle and their content I'm reading, because some things just don't make sense without being in this, without kind of stewing in this American context for a very long time, right? There's many debates here where I don't understand either side, because
You and
like
me both. I'm like, what? What did he just say?
the entire debate seems kind of pointless, and I don't understand why it exists, but it exists. And yeah, on many issues, I would say both parties, maybe it's because they mostly cater to a certain base of people who vote only in the primaries, and that has been the driving force. Or maybe it's just that because there are no term limits and you can get
Yeah.
reelected forever as an incumbent, you really benefit from issues festering. You don't benefit from solving an issue and moving on. And so there are a
Oh,
lot of issues that are completely solved in the world, like immigration systems. We can
yeah.
copy paste from our neighbors, and it would be much better than what both sides are saying in the US right now. And there's a lot of these kind of issues where, wait, what isn't that solved everywhere else? Why can't we just pick a model and copy paste? It will work better than any of what you guys are proposing.
Now, politicians don't want to cure a darn thing. They're out of a job if they do.
Well, I mean,
Opinion. I don't know that as a
Politicians still have
fact.
jobs in other places. It's just that they don't have
Okay.
job security if they solve it, because now you can pick another politician who's talking about solving something else, right?
Yeah, there you go. It's very sad. But again, when we're talking about how you're operating and you're giving people balanced news, both sides, somewhere in the middle, isn't that something that we should strive for as Americans, instead of just going, oh, I'm over here on the left, oh, I'm over here on the right. Why aren't you just being an American? I don't get that at all.
Well, we're somewhat wired for that evolutionarily, I would say, right? People like dividing themselves into teams and painting
Yeah.
different colors on their face.
Oh, there you
And,
go.
like think about any sports game, right? If a referee makes a decision against your team, are you shouting that the referee is right? Or are you shouting something about his mother?
Oh my God.
Right.
One
Generally speaking, people don't care if the decision was correct or not. They only care
Right.
about whether it wasn't in favor of their team. And so I think we're just seeing this now everywhere. And our politics looks like some odd combination of sports and religion, right? You have the fervor of religion
Yeah.
with the dynamics of being a sports fan.
Exactly. And when you bring your mom and your dog into it, oh my gosh, things are going to go bad very quickly. One of my
I used to
very,
referee some games as a kid, so
oh, you
I
did?
know what people say about referees.
One of my very favorite people in the world, he's a very dear friend, is Jim Tunney, and he's in his 90s now. He's known as the Dean of NFL referees. And he's one of the few referees, I think, that didn't have to take a whole lot of guff because he did his best to be fair, but he did take some. But some of his stories are amazing. But sometimes he told me a story one time where people mentioned his mother, his dog, and he looked and he said, "I don't have a dog." I said, "Okay." That was his answer. It's like, and by the way, don't talk about my mama like that. So, yeah, I get where you're going with that.
But I mean, this is what our politics is looking like, right?
It
It's
is, yeah.
not like we're seeing something that doesn't exist in any other context. It's being used in the wrong context. This is not supposed to be in politics. In politics, we're supposed to talk about what is the root cause of the problem and what is the fact. Are you sure? Can you corroborate that with evidence? Right? That should be the level of conversation. But the level of conversation we have instead is really the equivalent of your mama,
And you know, you're talking about politics here, but that should be the standard for any conversation we're having, whether it's with a checker at the grocery store. If something has you going, huh, that didn't make any sense, you can take a moment and have a conversation and say, really? That's interesting. Where's this coming from? You know, I mean, you don't want to stop the checkout line, but it's, you know, just you should always be able to, in my opinion, say, you know, that doesn't make any sense to me. Can you corroborate that? And have a decent conversation at all levels.
That reminds me, Peter Boghossian, one of the guys of the big academic hoax a couple of years ago, he actually had a segment called Street Epistemology, where he was walking around trying to convince people of, sensible things where their position was nonsensical on the street. And he was trying to show how you can convince people even when people are really kind of entrenched in their positions and are really emotional about it. So I'm not sure that I have the patience for that personally.
Oh, I know I don't. I try though.
But he has a PhD in philosophy, I think, so he can do that forever.
I'll have to go look at that. I'm familiar with the name, but I wasn't familiar with what he did. So, quick question. If big tech companies have contributed to the misinformation problem, which we've been talking about through ad-driven business models, how can a tech company like Otherweb be part of the solution?
Well, you start by trying to bind yourself in some sense, right? This is why we're a public benefit corporation. This is why we try to open the source code of our models and data sets to the world. This way, if we ever decide to do something nefarious, people will notice, right? That's one of the approaches here. The other one is just to try to build tech that fixes the problem rather than tech that just chases the shiny new thing, which is what most tech companies do, unfortunately. And I think a part of that is just how tech companies are typically funded early on, right? It's basically the same big funds for the most part. Everybody is talking to their neighbors. They don't live in the same area. They see what works for the other guy, so they do the same thing. So you get this kind of herd mentality. And we have the advantage of not being there, right? We're from Austin, not from Silicon Valley. That's somewhat helpful. And we also funded the company through crowdfunding. So we have a little over 2,000 investors that all contributed small amounts after trying the product themselves. And whereas most tech companies just have one or two big investors that probably don't even care about the product, they just go by metrics to make sure that it fits within their thesis of what's going to grow in the near future. So it's not like I want to disparage any of those models. I'm just using those to explain why tech companies tend to behave in similar ways for the most part. And the way that tech companies have behaved over the past 15, 20 years is, for the most part, trying to get as much attention out of you. That's been the entire game. And the best way to get attention out of you is to addict you to something so you keep coming back. That's one element. And the other one is to cause you to react in a strong way to whatever is in front of you. So strong emotions are a really good way to make you share, to make you react, to make you respond, to make you like or dislike, etc. And it's not healthy for you to basically have your emotions rattled more and more with everything that you're looking at. It's also not healthy for you to spend more and more time doing things that don't really benefit you in any way. Right? I remember the time when Facebook was celebrating being able to reach this amazing milestone of 20 minutes time on site, right? When the average Facebook user started spending more than 20 minutes on Facebook in a single session. TikTok is at 90 minutes now.
Oh my gosh.
So,
I didn't know that.
I'd love to get back to the Facebook of 2007. That was so much better in comparison. So it's all going in that direction. The industry is becoming really, really good, but we don't want to be a part of that game. We don't want to take people's attention and use that as currency, essentially. What we want is to give people value and hope that they reward us in return in some way, because typically that's how you're supposed to do business. You provide value, people pay for it.
Exactly. And Alex, you have mentioned public benefit corporation a couple of times, and I'll be honest with you, I don't know what that is.
Right. So that is a legal structure that It's probably about 10 years old in most states, though every state introduced that in a slightly different time, which basically looks a lot like a C corporation, which is what most companies in the US are, except you're supposed to write a mission that benefits mankind in some way as part of your incorporation papers. And that mission is binding on all the executives just as much as making money, right? So typically every corporation or every executive in a corporation has a fiduciary duty to maximize shareholder value. If he or she makes any decision that hurts shareholder value, let's say you donate company money to charity, right? Now the company has less money. The shareholders can sue you for violating your fiduciary duty. But if you have another mission written in parallel to that, and you make a decision that perhaps makes slightly less money, but in return, it maximizes this other mission, now you're protected from a lawsuit. So at least as an executive, you have the freedom to try to pursue a mission and not just to maximize shareholder value. That's kind of the legal structure. There is another element that companies often add, which is being certified as a B Corp, a benefit corporation, right? And we haven't done that because that's a third-party certification. It's not a government structure, and it requires a lot of paperwork, and we don't have the money for lawyers, basically, to do that. But one day, maybe we will, because it's still a nice signal to the world that you really care, and you're really making all your affairs public so people can see what you're doing to pursue the mission.
Thank you for sharing that. I had no idea. I mean, I knew, because I wrote down, ask him what this is, because I had no idea at all. And I'm glad to know that that's how you're operating. So, Alex, is there anything else? We're running out of time. This is fast as 60 minutes on the internet, I'm telling you. What else do you want to share with our audience before I very reluctantly let you go?
I'll go back to something that I said about half an episode ago, which is, I really hope people start paying attention to what they put into their brains. It's really important, right? Your brain is a wonderful machine. It has this perfect information processing machinery in it. But if you feed garbage in the inputs, then the outputs in the form of actions will probably be garbage as well. So I think people need to start being very careful about what inputs they allow to enter their brain, be much more selective, and be much more mindful about it. Plan it in advance, right? How much, like you mentioned that you have old encyclopedias and books. It sounds like if you plan your information diet, you should plan some time spending with those books and not just on Instagram or TikTok or whatever, right? And the same applies to all the people listening to us. I hope that they start planning. And I don't know what the answer is that they come up with, but if they choose that answer, it will probably be better than if they let Silicon Valley choose it for them.
You know, and you've mentioned mindfulness, and like I said earlier, I've never been a TV watcher. I didn't watch it as a kid. You give me a book though, and I'm all happy. You give me a stack of books, no talking, just everybody go away and leave me alone. But I realized in 2010, I believe it was, I didn't really watch TV, but I always had Fox News on in the other room, and I'd be listening to them. And it dawned on me more than once that my stomach hurt. I was actually having physical reactions to the garbage that was just being put out there over and over and over again without ceasing. And I said, that's it. And I shut it down and I've never gone back. And that's nothing against Fox News. It's all the same garbage wherever you go, as far as I can tell. But I would suggest to our audience, if you're reading and consuming and listening to things that are giving you physical issues, pay attention to those things. If your head's hurting, if your stomach's hurting, if you're shaking your head, pay attention and get away from that news.
And if I may add one more thing, because this is an interesting topic to dive into. There was a study done after the Boston Marathon bombing where the researchers looked at people who were present in the bombing and actually experienced the blast and compared them to people who watched at least 4 hours of news coverage of the bombing on TV. And the people who watched the news coverage were more likely to have PTSD than people who were there at the event. So you probably want to see coverage of an event like this. It's obviously very important, but think how much. 5 minutes is probably okay. 4 hours is clearly worse than experiencing a terrorist attack and being there in the blast radius.
You put me in mind of September 11th. I was driving down the street. I was going to go pay a bill or something, heard it on the news and came back home. Instantly turned. I don't think I paid the bill that day. My ex-husband got home later that day and I was sitting on the window seat with my cat. His name was Sawyer, you little bastard Griffiths. And he literally was on my chest and I was wiping my tears on him. God bless him. And he didn't say anything. He sat down and he watched it. The next day he came home, repeat. I was watching the same stuff over and over and over again. And he grabbed the remote. He said, "Is there anything new?" And I said, "No." He said, "You've seen it all. You have to stop." And he was right.
And that's exactly the point that we're kind of coming in a circle to, that you should plan how much of everything you want to get, because even if
Exactly.
something is good in moderation, like it's good to have dessert from time to time. It's not good to have it 6 times per day. And news is kind of like that. It's good to get it from time to time, maybe 10 minutes or 15 minutes in the morning with your coffee and newspaper, but it doesn't make sense to have it in your Instagram feed and your TikTok feed and on Facebook and on TV all the time while you're doing something else. All of that is just pollution.
And I think it's physically damaging and mentally damaging a lot of us. And I don't have any data to support that. It's just a feeling, based on my own experiences. But turn it off. Get what you need, turn it off, and go about your business.
It seems like all the data we need to corroborate that claim has already been published by a Facebook
Ah, there you go. Well, listen, thank you so much for being here with me today. I sincerely appreciate your company, and this has been a fascinating conversation. So I think you already shared your last thoughts, but how can people connect with you on the web, and how can they find other web? How can they get there?
We're on otherweb.com. And you can email me at alex@otherweb.com if you like it. If you don't like it, then definitely email me and tell me what's wrong with it so I can fix
There you go. Well, thank you.
it.
Well, listen to our audience as we conclude today's episode. Your feedback means a lot to me. And if you found the show helpful, please support us with a quick review on iTunes. Your input is vital in my mission to inspire and empower more individuals. So don't forget to hit subscribe, leave a review, and share your Partner in Success Radio with friends and colleagues. And be sure to find Alex Fink on the web. And go look for Other Web and connect with him. And thank you for tuning in. And I will see you next week. Alex, again, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Denise.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.